2950.
And that number again is 212-209-2950, or go to give to WBAI.org online. Give to the number 2, WBAI.org online. For a pledge of $175, you can get the Slavery by Another Name package, which consists of the book and the DVD, or you can get the DVD by itself for a pledge of $125, or the book by itself for $85. Either way will be a great way to show your support to this radio station. Stay tuned for Live on the Fly with Randy Credico, and this is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned.
Need Julian Assange. And one thing I want to say to you today is, it is not only that he is the victim of torture, it is not only that his life is at stake, it is not only that we want to save him from a dreadful injustice, we also want to save him because the world needs Julian Assange as a symbol and fighter for liberty in this place.
Okay, that was Craig Murray, former UK ambassador to Uzbekistan, historian, human rights crusader, political prisoner, Renaissance man, and he'll be joining us in just a minute. I'm Randy Credico. This is Randy Credico Live on the Fly here on 99.5 FM in New York City. And as Reggie said, try to get that package, Slavery by Another Name. Call that number, 212-209-2950. It's vital. You know, I was cut off of Facebook today. I couldn't post this show. I couldn't post this show on Facebook. I don't know if I'm banned or what, but I couldn't get anything through. Others are being banned or being censored. And this is like the last, this is the last, you know, fortress. This is it. We're being surrounded, Reggie. Got to support the station. Wait until this one's gone. Then you'll have nothing. You'll have to use two Dixie cups and a string. At any rate, Julian Assange got married with his longtime partner, Stella Morris, on Wednesday. Craig Murray was supposed to be one of the guests, so the six guests. He was not allowed in. We'll talk to him about that. We're going to have Craig Murray on. Julian's father is going to join us a little bit later, although he may be on the line now. He was there. He got in, John Shipton. And later in the second half, we're going to bring on Roger Waters. John Shipton is very busy today. So why don't we just play by the way, there will be an event in D.C. on the five-year anniversary of Assange's countdown to freedom, which started right here on April 11th. The day before April 10th, there will be a big event, Humorous for Assange, stand-ups for Assange at the Tabard, and we'll talk about that some other time. All right, with Lee Camp and Katie Halpern and a whole bunch of others. All right, so we're going to play a logical song. We'll be right back with the great Craig Murray.
When I was young, it seemed that life was so wonderful, a miracle. Oh, it was beautiful, magical. And all the birds in the trees, they be singing so sent me away, teach me how to be sensible.
Supertramp and Logical Song, and we are talking now with the Logical Man with his cup of tea, Ambassador Craig Murray. Do you like that title, Ambassador Craig Murray?
It's quite fun to hear it used again after all these years. Yeah,
yeah. You know, maybe you'll be a Sir Craig Murray at some point. You don't really relish that possibility, do you?
No. I'd been offered honours by the Queen three times during my career. I turned them all down because I don't believe in that kind of thing.
Wow. Do you know what's his name got one? Flashman got, I think, is it an OBE or something like that? Colonel Flashman? he was called Sir Henry Flashman, right? Anyway, Craig Murray, we're going to be joined by John Shipton in between our conversation because he's got to go. He's got a bunch of things happening, and I don't know where to start with you. You know, I spoke to you the other day at a, seemed like a very festive party after the wedding. But the wedding itself, Craig, can you give us an overview of what took place that day? Because I know you were supposed to get in and you didn't get in.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, John did get in and he's better able to tell you about the wedding than I am. But it was a joyous occasion, despite the attempts by the authorities to mess things about as much as they could. And one of the things they did to mess things about was when they were given the list of who was invited to say that certain people weren't allowed to attend. One of whom was me. And that, was a very unpleasant shock. And I was told that I wasn't allowed to attend, or Julian and Stella were told that I wasn't allowed to attend because I was a danger to the security of the prison, which I really found quite amusing, given that it's a maximum security prison housing Britain's most dangerous terrorists. I actually feel quite flattered by the idea that I'm a danger to the security of the prison.
I saw that, and it just beyond bemuses me, it confuses me. How is that possible? Also, they said that you were a journalist, which they said you weren't when you were framed on some charges 8 months ago. But now you are a journalist, so you can't get in. That just it is so confounding. Did you try anyway to get in?
I'm Schrodinger's journalist, apparently. I'm a journalist when they think I'm a journalist. No, I didn't sort of attempt to. And this is only it's a nuisance, and it was part of a process of messing Julian around, of which things like not allowing him to have a photographer and not allowing photographs to be published, there are other things as well. But I didn't want all of this to detract from the happiness and joy of the occasion, because, in a situation where this man has been subject, in effect, to torture and extreme detention for years and years and a deprivation of his liberty for no good reason whatsoever, this was a day where love triumphed over adversity. So I don't really want to concentrate on the petty cruelties which even on his wedding day that they were trying to heap upon him. I'd rather concentrate on the fact that, we managed to transcend that cruelty on this occasion.
At the event that night, I guess it wasn't at the Great Harry's. It was someplace else over there in Belmarsh. But were people pretty much upbeat in some way because it actually transpired?
I think that's right. I mean, Stella described the experience of the whole day as bittersweet, and I think obviously that's true. I mean, I can't imagine what it's like to marry the love of your life and then immediately be forcibly parted from them. And when, a fight is going on to ensure that Julian survives his prison experience and doesn't spend the rest of his life in jail. I mean, to marry in those circumstances must be extremely difficult, but we did manage to be happy, and we managed that evening at a very, very small gathering, which was very largely family and a few close friends.
John Shiptonites.
We managed to be celebrity rather than miserable.
Well, I posted a picture today. I know who was at that event afterwards and actually got in, and that's the father of Julian Assange, John Shipton. And last time I saw you two together was at the trial of Assange, the first segment of it way back on February 24th, 2020. And John Shipton is in London right now, and I think he's on the line. John, do we have you?
Yes. Hi. Hi, Randy. Hi, Craig. I'm in Rome.
Oh, you're in Rome. Oh, that's right.
You might hear some opera in the background. The neighbors are playing.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we got Craig on the other line. Now, Craig did not get in. That must have been a drag for everybody. And so you're the only one that I'm speaking to right now who actually got to see Julian Assange. And can you tell us, our listeners, what the experience was like for you?
Oh, well, the interminable searching, and then they got us upstairs into a room alongside the chapel. We weren't allowed to go into the chapel because it's a secular service, even though we had a Catholic service afterward. It's pretty tedious. What can I say? You know, it's a high maximum security jail. The firmest, if that's the right word, in the UK. That's not a pleasant place. But I suppose what I would do is take Craig's example and say, all right, you know, we have a circumstance here where love has triumphed over 13 years of ceaseless. And this is the United Nations statement, you know. Arbitrary detention extending over 13 years. On Palm Sunday, it'll move into the 14th year of arbitrary detention. And within that 14 years, the United Nations Rapporteur on Torture and Unusual Punishment declares, witnesses, we all witnesses, Craig witnesses, I witness, you witness, that the interior of that 14 years is psychological torture. Oh, that is an enormous burden for love to overcome, and it did, and clearly did, for there was, as they embraced and the priest said, you may kiss the bride, they kissed, and everybody in the room, as usual, hooted, and then after they stopped kissing, Gabrielle said, was it wet? And so the, you know, boyish, masculine humor and the beauty of the bride and the joy of them embracing. Actually, it was a bit of a shock to see them kissing because you can't imagine anybody kissing in that place. You know why? You know, it's sort of like kissing banned here. You've just walked into hell. No kissing. That sort of feeling. So I was shocked. But, yeah.
Hey, Craig, you can jump in at any time here. I know you guys spoke the other day, but if you have anything you want to ask Mr. Shipton, feel free.
Thanks. I've had the opportunity to, you know, get an account of it all from John, so I've nothing there to ask. But I would certainly say, you know, one of the great things for, having been in jail myself, one of the great things for Julian must have been that he was actually allowed to hug his family, because certainly, you know, normally at prison visits, no physical contact is allowed. And after you've been there, I was only there for a few months. Julian's had years and years of it, but you yearn for that human contact. It's extremely important to you. So this was, as as John says, a day that, that broke some of the bounds, and I'm sure was of a great help to Julian, although the pain of then being separated again must be immense. It's almost impossible to imagine the pain of marrying the love of your life and then instantly being separated from them. You know, it's just a terrible, terrible thing.
John?
Well, if I could, you know, use poetry and to outline what it is, what it actually is. And when I say 14 years, it's each of those years had 360-odd days, and each of those days had 24 hours, and each of them, each hour is 60 minutes, you know. So that's the amount of time that the Julian has been under a sort of a ceaseless torture, an immense mammoth burden mounting up as the days stretch into decades, and the decades multiply. And, you know, nobody wants to break. Nobody wants to break Mandela's record. That's, you know, that monstrous, crushing burden. Then you put in the face of it two beautiful children and the love that those, Julian and Stella, manifested, and the managing to, under the circumstances, being in jail, to force the government and force the Department of Justice and force the governor of the jail through threats of legal action to allow the bans to be called and the fulfillment of that relationship in the sacrament of marriage, carrying the tremendous burden of 14 times 365 times 60. It's just a wonder, really. Yeah.
Boy, it's got me in tears here.
Sorry.
No.
I just think that poetry is worth looking at because it gives meaning, you know, it gives real meaning rather than just saying 14. You know, it gives an extraordinary circumstance to an unbelievable persecution of a man who's simply a publisher, you know, his. I don't think he's ever poked anybody in the eye. And I can remember, you know, he reticent to get a parking fine. You know, don't park there, you might get a fine. So his core care in being legal, fair, truthful, accurate, precise, and yet for that. And also the gifts, he likes to sort of, you know, be thorough and give, you know, and expect no gratitude, but just to pour out from himself, like an artist an artist can't say, oh, well, I'm going to be an artist today. They just are, and it pours forth from them. And it is with Julian so in those years of his extraordinary creativity that it poured forth. And it's a real universal gift. I'm reminded of that saying, you know, no great gift goes unpunished. I don't understand life really, But there it is.
Right. I'm Randy Credico. This is Randy Credico live on the fly here on 99.5 FM in New York City, WBAI, WBAI.org. We're talking with John Shipton, the father of Julian Assange, and former Ambassador Craig Murray. Craig Murray, when I listen to John and he talks about all of these wonderful attributes of his son, outside of his family, I don't think anybody has gotten to know him better than you over the last 12 years. Just give us an encapsulation of the kind of character that you witnessed in those years that you were around in the embassy of Julian Assange.
I think the first thing to say about Julian, which people don't immediately realize, is that he's very funny. He's very good company and very sharp and amusing. He doesn't take himself enormously seriously. He's very genuine about what he's trying to do. He's very, very earnest in his mission to make society better by means of giving the public more access to truth and believing that the truth really can set people free, and that knowledge of the truth will stop wars, among other things. About all that, he's very earnest. But it doesn't mean that he views himself as a tremendously important person or is self-important in any way. He's not. He's a very, very affable, very friendly, very amusing companion, and with an enormous intellectual curiosity. And likes to discuss things and talk things through, as we often did together, where you feel that you're not starting from a fixed position. You're trying to understand and work through the issues and decide what you think about it. And I like that intellectual curiosity in Julian. And very, very good. Very good company, and not in the least offensive. The last person to be trying, as John has said, to hurt anybody. I can't imagine Julian setting out to hurt anybody. It really seems quite awful that somebody like him should be suffering in this way.
Well, why hasn't the British government, how come there's nobody there within that entire system that said, all right, let's ease up a little bit here and give them some space, let them get a picture taken, let them expand the amount of people coming in? Why are they so heavy-handedly cruel, Craig?
I think the enormity of the threat which Julian posed to, if you like, the established order, the idea of giving citizens direct access to first-hand documents and sources of information rather than that being filtered to them through the mainstream media, the fact that he did that, WikiLeaks has done it in many contexts, but of course including in the context of illegal war, torture and war crimes by the United States, all that was such a fundamental threat to the established order that I think he had to be, as far as they were concerned, he had to be dehumanized and destroyed. I think it really is no more than that. The severity of their treatment of him is proportionate to the danger which they believe he poses.
John, do you want to say something about that?
Yeah. So, well, the antipathy of the judiciary, it just make the point before we go any further that Julian has done nothing illegal, okay? There's nothing illegal in what he's done. And demonstrate that by the other publishers publishing simultaneously the same information and they remain unprosecuted. So there's nothing illegal in what he's done. The next point is that the Nuremberg Code quite clearly states that if somebody says you to commit a crime, you are responsible for that crime yourself. You can't say X told me to do it as an excuse. So the UK judiciary, 21 judges now, most of them from the Superior Court, demonstrates an antipathy towards Julian in their irregularity of treatment and the distortion and contortions of due process and their willingness to overlook the crimes of others, in this case, the CIA, the FBI, suborning witnesses, overlook the crimes of others in order to indulge a continuing antipathy in their judgments. And I had just spoken this minute to Michael Copleston, who is going up to Edinburgh, by the way, and hopes to have dinner with Craig. But he was, we spoke of his treatment by the Superior Court judges, which is severe and unusual. He's the psychiatrist that evaluated Julian and spoke for the defence. And he experienced in the higher courts a reputational tarnishing that has never, ever happened to him before in 40 years of appearing as a witness in cases where they needed a review of a defendant's psychology. Never happened before. So this antipathy of the judiciary and their contortions of due process and their allowing of irregularities. I remember during the court case, Craig was there with me, sitting alongside me, and with the secondary indictment, witnesses, defence witnesses, received the prosecution bundle of 800 pages a couple of hours before they were to give testimony. And the judge said nothing. Oh, this is usual. You know, one after the other, you find these cases where the judge sees fit to indulge contorted, strange due process and irregularities of witness testimony. It's disgrace, actually. It's they ruined the reputation of the Swedish prosecuting authority to the point where in Sweden there's all sorts of essays and inquiries as to what happened. Now, having ruined the Swedish prosecuting authority reputation for the administration of law, now you can cast your eye past the work of 21 judges in the case of Julian Assange and have the same feeling that they're committed upon themselves a disgrace and upon Julian Assange a continuing injustice.
It's very well said. We're talking with John Shipton and Craig Murray. Craig Murray, before we take a quick break, and I hope you both can stay, Roger Waters is going to come join us in about 5 or 6, 7 minutes. This is a very serious show. I want to ask you, Craig, you went through a Kafka-esque legal process yourself, and you ended up in a bad prison. They're all bad, especially when you're there and you can't see your kids and you have a newborn. What was it like just the 3 months? Did it seem like an endless quagmire that you were in that you were never going to get out? What were the conditions and what did it do to you psychologically?
Well, it was very difficult. It was 4 months, in fact, I was there. I was in a much better position than Julian in that it wasn't endless. I knew it was for 4 months. I knew from the start the day I would get out was Julian has faced this process that goes on for years and years, and the process itself is a part of the punishment in Julian's case. It's extremely horrible. One thing we had in common was, I was confined in a cell 12 feet by 8 feet for 22 and a half hours a day minimum, sometimes longer. effectively in solitary confinement, not able to have, you know, meaningful contact with anyone. That is very hard indeed. I was able to see family once for half an hour every 3 weeks. That was my visiting allocation. You know, these are deliberate and cruel and vindictive punishments of a quite extraordinary kind to visit upon journalists. So I have some idea of what Julian is suffering, but not really, because, as I say, his ordeal is indefinite, which must be the worst thing of all, and has gone on for years and years and years.
Yeah. It really is a tragic situation. And Craig, just quickly, was there in your head a breaking point? Like, how long do you think you could have remained in a situation like that where it was like, you know, you go to the other side?
That's hard to say. I'm glad to say that I believe I've come out of it without any sort of enduring trauma. And you adapt to where you are. You know, I found the individual guards were all extremely kind to me, as were, in fact, all the prisoners with whom I came in contact. They were unfailingly kind and pleasant to me. So on a day-to-day basis, it was a survivable experience, but for a limited period of time. I mean, if that were what Julian faces, is the prospect of that being his life, of that being the entire rest of his life. And I think if I'd faced that threat, I don't think I would have been able to survive it, no.
He's an extraordinary, resilient man. All right, you guys, can you please stay? We're going to take a quick break here. And Roger, who's been a big supporter of Craig and John and Julian and me, and he's been there, one of the great activists of our time and the most productive and profound maker of music, as I say, the last in my lifetime. We'll be right back after this quick break with Roger Waters and Craig and John.
The Eastern world, it is exploding. Violence flaring, bullets loading. You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war, but what's that gun you're toting? And even the Jordan River has bodies floating. But you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. Don't you understand what I'm trying to say? Can't you feel the fears I'm feeling today? If the button is pushed, there's no running away. There'll be no one to save with the world in a grave. Take a look around you, boy. It's bound to scare you, boy. And you tell me.
Okay, Eve of Destruction, Barry McGuire. I'm Randy Credico here in Brooklyn with Sophia, my new Coton de Tulliar, which Roger gave me as a gift, and she's in the studio with me. At any rate, we are talking with John Shipton, the father of Julian Assange, and Craig Murray, and let me know when Roger gets in there, and he's calling in. John, I was going to ask you this, and I think people want to know, you were around him for 2 hours. What was it like? What was his parents like and his attitude?
Well, you know, he had all his family around him making fuss and you know, stroking and and smiling and, you know, hugging and so on. And also it was, you know, the bands had been called some months ago, and so the fulfillment of the marriage ceremony with the, you know, Gabrielle had, he was in full Scottish regalia. His mum is a Scot. And so we had the immense majesty of the Scottish kilt and jacket there standing alongside the bride. And then I was standing alongside Julian and the kids sort of running around, ruining the timing and causing the guards to dash hither and yon to make sure emergency buttons weren't being pushed. So you can see there's the usual, you know, circumstances of a marriage, you know. So, his heart was light. He didn't pull any wry faces or overreact. Actually, I found with Julian, even though now, you know, as I've described, it's 14 years of rough going, he's never once complained to me about this. Never said, oh, you know, this is rough going, I can't take any more of this. He just once, on June 2019, he said, oh, will I come back you know, help with the fire? And that's the only time he's ever asked for anything. So you can see that he's has considerable inner resources.
Yes.
Well, that's the evidence is there. Otherwise, he wouldn't any longer be with us.
Cool. Yeah, absolutely. We are joined by Roger Waters right now. Good afternoon, Roger. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, Randy.
Well,
Roger. Hi.
Hey, John.
Good to see you. How are you going?
Great. I've been sitting here listening to you guys.
Yes. Well, any thoughts about what you've heard thus far?
Well, obviously, I looked at all the pictures of the wedding yesterday, and they were deeply moving. I mean, I didn't see Julian, but Stella was stunning, obviously. Loved the frock, Vivian. Thank you for that gift for the day. It was all very moving and disquieting, almost in similar measure. You know, I can't imagine what it was like to be there. I'm not surprised that Craig had a hangover afterwards, as I'm told. But I have a very, very fine network of spies everywhere to tell me everything that's going on. And I feel like, maybe we all do, I feel as if I'm right at the bottom of the rabbit hole. You know, it seems that the life that we're forced to lead because of the punishment meted out to good people like Julian, who sadly there aren't that many of him, by the state, leads us to believe that that our lives are being written by Franz Kafka and Lewis Carroll. We're either halfway down the rabbit hole or we're in a jail cell somewhere. And so I found myself sitting here knowing that I was maybe going to get a phone call from you guys and Randy this afternoon, thinking, to quote myself, is this the life we really want? And the answer, of course, is no, it's not. We want a life that isn't the life described in the trial or in Alice Through the Looking Glass. We want a life where sense, common sense prevails, and humanity and love and all those things that the British judiciary, not to mention the British government and the American government, in fact, all the bloody governments, as far as I can tell. Well, not all, actually. I should be careful what I say, because there are some governments who apparently care more about the people than they do about trade. I'll stop rambling now, but I am sort of flabbergasted that here I am, age 78, and that we are in this state, that we have somehow allowed ourselves to descend to these depths of Reagan-esque and Thatcherite depravity. But we have. And so that is why we so desperately need Julian back to help us somehow claw our way up the side of the rabbit hole to the daylight that must be there somewhere and the open fresh air for us to all breathe again, because this is a nightmare.
Yeah, yeah, very well said. Craig, how do we try to maintain our optimism at this juncture?
Well, it is hard because probably like Roger, you know, many of us feel that we've just watched society get worse and worse and worse over the last few decades. And greed become accepted as the ultimate motivator. People seem to have forgotten that altruism exists and people do things to help others because they love them and wish to care for them. The idea is that everybody just wants to get as much as they can, and governments work on that basis, as though enabling kindness and enabling people to be cared for is not their job. Their job is to assist those who wish to accumulate very large sums of capital. And we've seen the gap between the wealthy and ordinary people just grow and grow and grow. And there does appear to be no immediate stop to this trend. But my own view is that it is unsustainable. You know, when you reach a stage where you have people, even in countries like the United States and the United Kingdom, who are literally starting to not be able to afford to eat, who are in danger of actually dying of malnutrition because they have no money, and you have other people who are accumulating fortunes of anything between, you know, $10 and $100 billion, that's an unsustainable situation. And in the end, you're going to reach a stage where people simply revolt because they're not prepared to starve to death while others prosper. I'd much rather we returned to a society where think ideas which certainly in the UK were accepted, like utilities and major public industries of major public benefit being owned by the state, like social provision for all, like people being able to go to university without paying for it all. I'd certainly like to believe we can get to a stage where we return to that without having to go through any kind of violent revolutionary movement in the meantime. But it's very hard to see that coming. I'm sorry, we've moved a long way from discussing Julian.
We have. But
well, no, we haven't. We haven't, because everything that you've just said, Craig, shows us how desperately we needed WikiLeaks when it was there, and we need it to be reinstated now that it's not there, because we live in a world that is ruled entirely by state propaganda in connivance with the mainstream media and so on and so on. So we desperately, desperately need Julian, and that is why they are behaving with such criminal contempt in his case, because they're scared of him. They're frightened. They are terrified of the idea that Julian's trying to propagate, that we, the electorates in all these supposed democracies, need information so that we can make informed decisions about the life we really want, and explain to our political leaders that that is what we want, that what Craig's just described is what we want, what you and I believe in and what Julian believes in is what we, the people, want and need and demand. They're scared. They're so frightened. So I hope Craig is right, that we're teetering somewhere near the tipping point where common sense and the power of love will take over from commerce, and that we will find it within our hearts to demand this change in the state of affairs that's extant in the world at the moment.
I'm Randy Credico, Randy Credico Live on the Fly here, talking with Craig Murray, Roger Waters, and John Shipton. I want to ask you, you know, I think there's an element of optimism that you always carry around. You've gallivanted around the U.S. You're indefatigable. What keeps you going here? And you, I know you're going to continue to go forward.
Just the poetry of life. If I know this musical term, it may strike a chord, but in the Middle East over the last 20 years, an academic in Melbourne, Australia, who specializes in excess deaths, calculated the direct deaths in the 20-year period of the destruction of seven countries are around 6 million souls, 6 million people. And the Brown University calculates that there are 36 million people, refugees, looking for homes because their communities have been destroyed. Well, the flux, and one other element, is that offences against the children cannot be forgiven. Now, that doesn't mean to say that there's somebody sitting up in the sky watching. What it is an analogy that if you offend against children, you offend against the future of your being. As a consequence of what I described, the millions of people dead and the pall of grief that sits above the Middle East, a dark cloud, the flux of life itself will not bear these insults. And you can see now that the United States in its foreign policy and the United Kingdom in its foreign policy staggers from bad to worse, from threat to clumsiness, from loud screamings against China and Russia about this and that and the other. You see, that indicates that they are flailing. The flux of life simply will not bear. And you can have examples in history of Belgium and the deprivations that the Belgians committed against the Congos, where they destroyed the lives of many people and ruined the communities. And now you see Belgium, it barely exists. It only holds together because the EU and NATO have headquarters in Brussels. Otherwise, it would have disappeared and gone to dust. Right. And so that is what motivates me, keeps me going, because I believe that the flux of life will not bear these profound insults against its being.
Well, by the way, the name of the book is King Leopold's Ghost, about Belgium, by Adam Huxchild, who was on this show a couple years back. Craig, there's two questions. I don't know which one to ask. One, what are we missing without Julian right now? What is the world missing without Julian? And is the U.S. and maybe the U.K. failed states, empires that are like going into the sinkhole, and this all of this stuff that they're doing is an act of desperation?
Well, on the first, I mean, we're missing Julian's leadership on many issues. What I've discussed with him, and I would most like him to be able to lead us on again, is recovering internet freedom. Because WikiLeaks really flourished at a time when internet freedom appeared to be really revolutionising the world. That has changed. It's become hardened. The corporate gatekeepers like Twitter and Facebook, I suppose Instagram, TikTok, these corporate gatekeepers have come really to dominate internet traffic and control the flow and control what can be said. They all have highly establishment figures now deeming what is true and what is not true, often in a very controversial way, and what you're allowed to say and what is beyond the limit of what ought to be said in their view. And the internet freedom has never been so under threat. In fact, and the extent to which it can be said to exist at any significant level anymore, I think is limited. And I think that, you know, this is precisely the area of Julia's expertise and the sort of thing he could be helping us with. On the UK, US, you know, diminishing empires. Well, yes, of course that's true. And I think there's no doubt whatsoever that 2 decades from now, China will be undoubtedly the dominant power in the world. How precisely China will use that power and authority, I'm not quite sure. The days of the dollar as the currency of reserve are obviously very much limited. China could already, with the dollars it has, could already buy up every share in every company on the FTSE index if it wished to. So, you know, the world is changing, and we are seeing, you know, the lashing out of declining powers a little bit like the kicking legs of a dying cockroach.
Right. Roger, you know, what do we discuss this all the time. You know, what do we do from here? In the case of Julian Assange, I mean, I do this radio show, I do comedy shows, and what little I can do, and everybody does something, there'll be a rally here, a rally there, not that many people show up. What is a prescription that you could give us here in terms of how people can help?
Well, Randy, if I knew the answer to the $64,000 question, I would tell you in a heartbeat. Believe me, somewhere it is carved in my heart. But how to communicate it, how important this wonderful man is to the rest of us, I don't know. John was talking about poetry, and I just threw this up on my screen here. This is a poem of mine, and unashamedly, I'm going to read it. I'm not sure how relevant it is, but it's something I wrote after G.W. Bush was elected for the second time. I just want that thing when voices join in harmony, and in that fleeting moment, meaning coalesces there, all dark dissolving clouds the alleyways no more, and fresh bread scent of home pervades the air. No sandal soles in dust of broken homes, nor calloused toes heap bloody from the garment hem, and all the big parades and shock and awe and swagger on the carrier's deck and medals jangle helpless in the face of what is fair. I just want that thing when friends draw in, some living, some bygone, some missing, none forgotten, all beloved, everyone. Then hurl the glass into the fire and well up unashamed my heart beyond the reach of fear and faith, blind, bigoted and drear. And then across the great divide rise men and women unafraid to dash in loss their bracelets at the wall. And hearing them, hope holds me in its thrall. I just want that thing when empathy prevails, when man evolves beyond the crass and reason comes of age. Wow. Dogma, cant, and witchcraft are all banished to the past, when voices join in harmony at last. Wow. So that's my contribution.
That was beautiful. That was very, really beautiful. This has been an extraordinary show.
Thank you.
I say goodbye, I'm going to say goodbye to all three of you. But I want you, John. You got 1 minute left. Anything you would like to finally convey before we go?
We'll be back in New York City in May, and I hope to do another one of those really fabulous meetings that we had with you as MC and Roger and myself and Gabrielle and Chris Hedges and Aaron Maté. That was really, you know, first class, and it set us rolling. And in the United States, and we rolled on to a very successful tour, and we have another one in May. Hope to do it here again.
Wow. Wow. That we look forward to seeing you in May. I wish you could be in New York City.
Me too.
In New York City, in or D.C. on the 10th, the anniversary of this show. Assange Countdown to Freedom will be in D.C. for 2 days on the 10th and 11th of April. And we all look forward to seeing you again, John. And Craig, we'd like to get you out here, Craig. Are you banned from coming to this country?
No, I'm one of the few British people who actually has an American visa. You normally don't need them, but I have a 10-year American visa.
All right, we're going to get you here. We have a sponsor that's going to bring you out here, Craig.
If there's whiskey, I'll come. But I have one thing I want to tell Roger, which is that when I was in jail, a gentleman from Germany sent me a piece of paper with the word "resist" printed on it, which had been fired into the ear at one of your concerts. That actually helped me a lot. But that having, I pinned it on my wall and had the word "resist" to stare at every morning. And you didn't know when you had that fired at your concert how your act of resistance and declaration would come to help me one day in the jail in Edinburgh. And that's what, you know, the actions we take in trying to counter the world we live in can have effects we don't expect.
I want to thank all three of you. That's great. I'm Randy Credico. You've been listening to Live on the Fly. We're going to go out with I Wish You Were Here. This is Roger in London last year. See you guys. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Bye, thank you, John. Thank you, Roger. Thank you, Craig.
Bye, Roger. Bye, Craig.
Bye, John. Craig.
This is Gloria J. Brown Marshall, host of Law of the Land and author of She Took Justice, The Black Woman, Law and Power. And this is a profile in women's history. Sojourner Truth was born Isabel Bomfrey in 1797 in upstate New York. Sojourner Truth believed women lacked a voice in court, and she would have her opportunity to lead by example in three cases. Truth's first lawsuit was brought to regain custody of her young son, Peter, 5 years old, who was kidnapped by slave traders. The Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 spurred these abductions. Little protection was available through the courts or law enforcement. New York law prohibited the abduction of free Africans for enslavement. Perpetrators could receive a fine or imprisonment. However, the tepid effort on the part of law enforcement meant Africans in the northern free states had only themselves for protection against bounty hunters. First, Sojourner Truth searched on foot over many miles for those who had kidnapped Peter. Truth tracked them down, but knowing the courts would offer her only meager assistance, these men willingly admitted to the crime. However, Truth sought the assistance of Quakers and other abolitionists, who helped her retain an attorney. Since Peter had been born into slavery, however, there was no birth certificate to indicate that she was his mother. And the man who had Peter had severely beaten him, to the point that Peter denied Truth in court, crying out as if his mother was some terrible monster. But Truth persisted. The court ruled the boy was indeed her son, and they were reunited. Truth's second lawsuit was for defamation. She was a minister who was accused of a terrible crime. But she brought her lawsuit and won, receiving a $125 defamation award in damages. Her third lawsuit was in Washington, D.C. Truth was trying to board a streetcar there. The conductor began to drive away, dragging Sojourner Truth several blocks, causing great physical injury and humiliation. Truth had that conductor arrested. Later on, he lost his job and was convicted. Sojourner Truth says, if women want more rights than they got, then they need to just take them and not be talking about it. Sojourner Truth, is this